Luckily, Ben Ennis has a rink. Today, these are the type of days where you can just send the boys outside and have them skate around, you know, to warm up.
Yeah.
On the nice ice that you spent a lot of time on. It's good. How's it going, buddy?
It's going great. Yeah. No, honestly, I had just maybe yesterday finally gotten over the fact that I dumped, the entire city of Burlington's water supply into a hole that allowed me to skate on it for 2 days.
Yeah.
And then it turned into spring.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, thank you for bringing that back up.
No problem.
I'd kind of gotten over it.
I think I'm actually pretty good at that. I think I'm really good at just when people are moving past something, I'm really good at having the timing to know, and now, you know? Now.
Pulling the scab right off. It's like the scab's almost healed.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like, it's right there.
Yeah.
It's like, oh,
yeah.
Maybe it'll fall off on its own soon.
Yeah.
You're like, nah.
No, I'm like,
get that thing bleeding again.
Yeah, exactly. I'll jump in there. I'm ready to mix it up. I actually have, to start the show today, do you remember what we used to do, Who's the Bad Guy?
Yeah.
Vaguely,
and it was always
right?
You were the bad guy.
No.
That's the answer. You're like, I yelled at somebody on a train.
Yeah.
Who's
no.
the bad guy? It's like, no, the guy that got yelled at, for sure.
Okay, well, again, I don't think that this is the right panel of people to be asking, because this is a group of folk that, I don't, like, you go to, what's the Play Dome called that you guys go to with the children? Like, everything you're doing, you do with children now.
Yeah.
So all your activities are, you actually can never have confrontation, because confrontation in front of your kids is super lame, right? So you can.
I don't know.
Yeah?
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. All right. There you go. That's not bad. My two young fellas in the studio right now, like, one of them never goes outside. Like, he has no concept of even, like, being at an establishment or a restaurant. Like,
that's the future. That's.
I know. He is. No, he is the future. What's crazy?
Generation.
What's crazy is he's the older of the two youngs. But he's still, like, he'll just not go outside. He's, like, literally, the things that excite him the most are, like, reasons to stay inside more. Whether it's binge-watching one of those dragon shows or Harry Potter. Like,
why go outside when you have the whole universe of Harry Potter?
That's what I mean. I told him today, like, there's nothing I'm more confident in than this kid dying with, like, a bunch of regrets. maybe I should have done anything, you know? That would have been, that's going to be his MO. Okay, so who's the bad guy today? You know, who's the bad guy? You need people like me, as based out of Scarface, for those that you don't know. A movie that at one point in time, people my age thought was like the defining movie of our times. And now if you made me rewatch Scarface, I don't think I could get through 20 minutes.
What are you I literally just rewatched it this month.
I don't think so.
It's a classic. Brian De Palma, are you kidding me? Like, what are you talking about? How can you possibly denigrate Scarface?
I just don't think I could do it. I'm just saying. I have not rewatched it since I was maybe first year university. And
close to the peak of his powers.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think I could do it. Anyways, I digress.
Who's the bad guy?
Who's the bad guy?
You're already the bad guy.
No, I know. This is what I mean, is I would need, if I was my own defense, which I am, I'd be asking to have you removed from the jury. I'd be like, yeah, that guy, obviously that
Bias.
Guy's got to go. He said I'm the bad guy when I walked in here. Seems pretty bad. Okay, so I go out for a drink with a friend, and we walk into, like, a bar. It's just a bar, and it's one that gets, you know, fairly busy-ish, but it's a Thursday, and it's cold outside, and it's just, you know, we're stopping in for one drink, right?
Okay.
Stop into this bar, and I walk inside, and I was wearing my glasses like a nerd, because I'm still trying to heal my eye from mystery ailment that it's finally done, but now I'm afraid to go back to contact lenses. So I'm wearing my glasses. It's cold outside. I walk in. I have to take them off because they fog up. And the bartender says something to me. And I'm like, and I'm already moving to go, like, sit down at this table. And I look back at the bartender. I'm like, sorry, what? He's like, how many? I'm like, oh, just the two of us. We're just stopping in quickly for a drink. And he's like, can you sit at one of the tables for two? And I look, and the only table available for two is, like, right in front of the freezing cold door. There are five tables for four people lined up against the wall where there's no people. And then everybody in the bar, it's all twos. And they're all packed in the back and in the front in all the two-seaters. I got to sit, like, jammed in between them, or I can have a wall seat where there's a seater for four. And I looked at him. I was like, are you serious? And he went, yeah, those are for four people. Please take a two-person one. Sit anywhere you want where it's a two-person one. And I was like, how about I move if people come in? And my friend immediately, like, stabs me in the back, goes, oh, we'll just go sit in the two. I'm like,
oh,
like,
no,
now I've lost the leverage, right?
Yeah.
So now I have to do it. But who's the bad guy? Me? Because I was pissed. And then the entire night, I'm just staring at these open tables, right? And then, of course, naturally, a couple of twos come in and sit and occupy these tables. Meanwhile, I'm crammed into the two-seater. It sucked so badly because the bartender who told that to me, he sucked, but then my server was great, and I was stuck in this impossible position of going like, I know they're splitting this tip. I know this guy is getting this. And so I obviously ended up saying, well, who's the bad guy? Who's the bad guy?
Well, no.
Me for pushing back?
Yeah, no, this means a lot because, like we established, I am biased against you, but obviously you're not the bad guy
in that instance. Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, you should have. What you really should have done was say, oh, yeah, sorry. Did I say two? I meant, like, we're waiting for two more. We actually got four.
Yeah,
coming,
but.
So. You just lied. Lying is always the answer.
That situation doesn't need a lie. Like, if it was jam-packed, right? If that place was packed and there was one table left and they went, oh, sorry, we're reserving this for four, I'd been like, oh, okay, well, these guys are clearly doing such crazy business. But again, it was freezing cold outside. It's a Thursday. It wasn't going to be one of those nights. And it wasn't. Like, it was not one of those nights. I was just pissed. And then the drink is ruined for me, right? Because now I'm sitting at a table I don't want to be sitting at. And my friend is talking to me. And I'm just like, yeah, I don't care. Like, I don't care.
That is kind of your way, though.
Yeah, I want to do is stare at this bartender and have him acknowledge that these tables are still open. Like, I just want him to come over and apologize. And the entire night, I'm like, I'm going to say something else. And they're like, please don't. I'm like, I need to. I didn't.
Did you? No,
because I wish I could say I was the bigger person, but he just was not around when I was leaving. I don't know where he went, the bathroom or whatever. I would have said something. I was so ready to be like, hey, wow, thank God we went and sat at these tables. Otherwise, it would have been a disaster in here tonight. Like, truly.
No. The only comparable I've ever had is I went to some place for lunch. It was like, it was a Lebanese place. I went with my wife. And there was literally nobody else in there.
Yeah.
We wanted to sit like near the window, which was, I guess, far away from the kitchen. And the server was like, hey, do you mind moving like closer to the kitchen so I don't have to walk as far? I was like, you can't be. And then, of course, like throughout the course of the lunch, like I had to call her over multiple times because she was not checking on us to bring
us. Oh, my God. Yeah, no, that's a nightmare. That's what I'm saying. I was saved by the server. Had it been like this one bartender who continued to give me bad service and was a like real jerk about it, then, yeah, I would have had a probably, like, real conflict that would have involved maybe just a touch of raised voice. Mm. I got to tell you, man, I've brought this up. I don't want to try to wage war on the service industry because I love servers. But we grew up in a different time, I think, a little bit. Like, pre-pandemic service industry and especially different places. Like, you'll meet people, right? And if you go on a date, a lot of women will go, well, I judge you based on how you treat the staff, right? Or whatever, the service industries. I'm like, first of all, whoever takes the stance. If you take a stance publicly against a server, like, that's one of the worst positions you can take. You could never get away with that. Like, the whole restaurant, someone might fight you. Like, you're not getting away with that. So who does that, first of all? But we have gone so far now with the service industry to be like, sure, we'll tip 25% on everything we're doing. Sure, give us terrible service. Sure, speak to the customer like they're an idiot. And it's like, it's part of the Toronto post-pandemic charm is like, they think they're still frontline workers or something. Like, I don't know what it is. They think that they're like...
Is it post-pandemic or is it this country?
No, it was, I don't remember it pre... Like, there was places, of course. Like, you could run into your odd place where... There's something about this city where an establishment, the worse they treat you, it's like they're like, the cooler we are. And I do hate that. But this is something new. This is like, again, this is like a half-empty bar on a Thursday, and this guy is sassing a customer about sitting at a four-person table. Like, yeah, man, come on. It's different. It has changed. The tone has shifted. We've gone too far. Basically, what I'm saying is it's time to bring back disrespecting servers. It's like they've gotten too much. It's gone too far. We need to rebalance the scales here. It's gotten completely out of control.
I will say there is a distinct difference I've found in doing a lot of traveling to the United States, having an American wife.
Oh, yeah.
and going to a restaurant.
Land of the customer is always right.
Yeah, and I don't want to.
Yeah, just do it.
This is just my opinion,
okay? Don't be
such
a coward. Don't
take this as gospel.
Well, yeah,
but
no,
I will say, here's where my brain goes when I go to a country without universal health care, you know, without the same social safety nets that we enjoy in this country.
Where is this going? Okay,
is that there's people are more appreciative of having their jobs in the United States than here, right?
Okay. All right.
And I that's the only explanation I can come up with other than like Southern hospitality, going to Texas. And yeah, it's not all great there, but I will say, people who serve you do it with a smile and are just generally cheerier. And maybe that's just like
my server was good.
My server was really great.
Like a really great server. But the bartender.
There's no good servers here.
Yeah, yeah. No, there are some good servers. I'm just saying, as my sister who has long worked in the service industry, you know, she's going to get wind of this and be very upset. And that's the other thing, too, is like the service industry people, they like you even try to joke about this stuff and they can't take it even for 2 seconds. They're like, well, actually, here's what goes on. And you're like, oh, here we go. Like, now we got to hear about the most hard done by group, the most disenfranchised group on planet Earth, the servers. Oh, thank you so much for cracking my beer and handing it to me. Oh, 25. 5%, is that enough? Buddy. Oh, sure, be rude to me. Yes, no, spit in my face.
Oh, my goodness.
I'll do whatever. Oh, do you need me to mop the floor later? Yeah, I got you. Don't worry about it. Anyways,
you
moving
go
on.
Out for dinner in the city and, like, yeah, you've just upped your odds of having bodily fluid in your next meal.
I thought, 20%. I was like, thank God this guy's in plain sight, because if he wasn't, I wouldn't have stayed. There's no way. If he wasn't, like, directly in my eye line, I'd have been out of there. I'd have gone, yep, I know what this is, and I'd rather not drink any spit tonight, so I'll see you later. Anyway, so I'm having you on for a couple of reasons. One, it was not to have my spit intake be upped by 10,000% around every restaurant that I go to in the city. This is where it is good to have anonymity, right? Like, someone will listen to this, they'll be like, I'll show him. You don't know what I look like. You'll never see me again. You'd never notice me out. So I want to talk about Full Swing with you. I watched every episode, and I want to talk about new baseball rules and you being wrong. Where would you like to begin?
Well, I definitely want to save me being wrong till like the very end, by which I mean like hopefully rag the puck long enough that we never get to me.
I mean, you are right now, though. You're right now.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
So let's not start there.
Okay.
I finished Full Swing last night as well.
Okay, good. So you want to start with that?
Yeah, we can start with that.
Okay.
Great show. You know, I had
great show. Okay, so that's what you're going to go with. It was a great show to you.
I had Dylan Dettier on my show last night, who's basically the narrator of the whole thing. He's a golf writer, former mini tour professional golfer.
Yep.
And he was great. And I love the show. Yeah, of course you don't think I watched 8 episodes of the behind-the-scenes PGA Tour, Live Tour, golf show and didn't love it? Of course I loved it. What are you talking about? You didn't love it?
No, I actually enjoyed it. And I would say this, if I was doing reviews. Episode 1, nightmare. Awful, terrible, 0 out of 10. Episodes 2 through 5, like, solid to good. And I enjoyed all of them. Like, I especially enjoyed the Joel Dahman one where Damon. Yeah. I especially enjoyed that episode, obviously.
He's a breakout star.
Yeah, he is. Like, he is now going to be someone. He's so relatable. He's just a cool guy. He's had an interesting story. There's just tons to like about the guy. He's just clearly one of those guys that you spend 5 minutes with and you go, oh, I enjoy this person. His caddy, his relationship with him, great. His wife, all that stuff. Everything about Joel Dahman was enjoyable. Episodes 6 and 7 were dreadful and boring and just kind of like, all right, like we're doing the same script for storytelling about just an individual golfer. And then episode 8 with Rory was the most compelling one, obviously. They closed with it, but it was it was too little too late for me with the show from this standpoint. If you're asking me like, hey, JD, did you enjoy watching the show? I would say, well, yeah, because I like embedded sports stuff. And so this content is kind of like right up my alley. And yeah, I didn't have, other than episodes 7 or 6 and 7, where I kind of felt like I was getting a little drowsy watching some of it. I was like, I like Tony Finau, but once you start to try to get into like golfer, like, what?
Colin Morikawa picking out his golf outfit.
Yeah, like
the olive on the pink, whether that worked for him. It didn't.
It was pretty dry, those two episodes. I think even you would admit that once they went into the Chilean guys, I was like, oof.
This Mito, who, by the way, is now on the Live Tour. Sure. Both of those guys are on the LIV Tour.
Yeah, great. So they're traitors to the PGA. I did come out of it feeling more staunch in my I'm a PGA guy stance. But this was my goal for the show, or this was my hope for the show. My hope for the show was that because it was a box-to-box production, the F1 series production, that is what these sports are looking for. Like tennis and golf, by hiring this production company, they're not just looking for slick packaging to deliver their sport, because they have that already. They're the PGA. They can hire any good production company on earth. And this sort of gets to what it reminded me of a bit was the Toronto Maple Leafs ruining HBO's 24/7 hockey series, where you go, yes, this is embedded, and yes, I am enjoying this, but this isn't nearly as good as it once was because there's just way too much filtered out, and the access is kind of surface level. And so to me, like, the way they sold this show was, we were embedded at the perfect time. We were embedded right as guys were starting to go to LIV Golf, and Rory is, quote, all in, and these are the personalities we have involved in it, and wow, what a time this is going to be. And to me, the major failing of the show is that we barely get anybody on record about leaving for LIV. I think DJ and Brooks were the only two that kind of gave answers. Poulter was brutal. I think Poulter's the biggest loser of the show. Like, there's absolutely no, if you watch the show and you stand by Ian Poulter in any way, it's like, whoa, I have nothing to say to you. But
I don't know. I sympathize with the guys who are like, I just want to work less. I stink now, and I want to get a bigger paycheck and see my
DJ.
Kids more.
Yeah, DJ. But I did think it was kind of funny when these guys are literally like taking private jets, and you're seeing the purses of the tournaments they're winning, and they're like, yeah, and we could just set up our children for generations. And I'm going, oh yeah, is the Gretzky DJ family really worried about their kids having finances down the line? Like, are they?
No,
really?
The kids with the guys with no kids too are the biggest cowards.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
Brooks Koepka. It's like, oh, I can't make short putts anymore. I'm in the prime of my career. Time to take the cash.
I got a lot of Koepka thoughts because I do want to go through the winners and losers. Anyway, my critique is just simply this: is like, I enjoyed the show from my viewership standpoint, but for my hope of, hey, now we, like, if LIV Golf is actually going to have a greater purpose other than just being like the Saudi blood money league that got the rich guys richer, and yay, the PGA Tour guys got more money too, hooray. Like, who cares about that? What I cared about was, hey, are they going to take a sport that is oftentimes criticized for not seeming competitive enough or not having enough juice and rivalry because of just the money? Are they going to show the behind the scenes and get us access where guys really don't seem to like each other and guys kind of take some snipes and some barbs? And there's one moment with Rory where he takes a shot at Phil at in the eighth episode. It's the best part of the show. Yeah, it was. It was a swear. I actually want the shirt. Like, the shirt would be a really great shirt to wear at like a golf tournament if you were a Rory supporter. Yes. I think that'd be a very good one. But for the most part, it's just like they sort of let the LIV guys off the hook. They mention it a couple of times. I think that they put them in a bit of a bad light based on doing this.
They show the CNN and the news coverage, and they lay out the moral implications of them joining the Saudi league, which I thought was especially interesting considering they wanted access to those guys too, right? Like, they had a full-on sit-down with DJ.
Yes.
Right? And going forward, those guys, I get, it's not a PGA Tour production. It's just, it's this box-to-box production. So they're not in bed with either side.
I just, from a first season standpoint, I'm pretty let down in the fact of, I don't think that this is like the F1 show where it's creating any new fans. I don't think that someone is watching this.
You know what?
Yeah.
Not to cut you off, but speaking to Dylan yesterday, he had a great point that most people didn't come around to Drive to Survive until like season 2 or season 3, right? Like, it was a slow burn.
No,
and
that's not true.
Also, my
wrong.
Point to him was, no, it's 100%
no,
true.
He's wrong.
I know I didn't jump in on season 1.
No,
right
you
away.
Didn't jump in right away because you weren't aware of it, and it became like a huge pandemic show. But no, man, the first episode of Drive to Survive is one of the most memorable episodes. It's Daniel Ricciardo returning to Monaco with the underlying story of Max Verstappen, who is from Monaco, taking over the Red Bull car, and the dynamic between
the
two guys.
You watched it like when it was released? Like the week that it was released.
No, I didn't know it was like a show.
Exactly, this is what I'm talking about. But also, I mean, the figure
you
that
really think people are
going
to come back around to watching Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth going, we're frenemies, even though there's no evidence that they're actually there's any tension
also,
between the two of them whatsoever.
Like they play into every preconceived notion you might have about a pro golfer. It's like guys from Means who had the giant
it was
safety
a nightmare.
Net of Justin Thomas, whose dad was a tour pro and his grandpa was a pro. It's like, wow, what an incredible story of overcoming adversity.
Horrific start to the show.
No, that was rough. No, but the key to this whole thing, if you want to build it out or you want to imagine it being built out, is the guy that's just kind of like a shadowy figure throughout the whole eight-part series is Tiger Woods, right? And obviously, it's going to be extremely difficult to get buy-in from him, but he is bought into growing the sport and keeping the PGA Tour as relevant as possible. And the point I was making to Dylan was that Lewis Hamilton was not a part of Drive to Survive Season 1, right? And eventually did buy in. He was like, oh, this is actually important to me. It's important to this sport. I could see a world, and okay, you're not going to get the Joel Damon buy-in where you get to see Tiger Woods at home, and we didn't see that with Rory either, right? We hear him talking about his daughter and, you know, he's in clubhouses at tournaments, but you never see even his, I guess he did one interview in like a room that I guess is maybe his house, but you don't see any of his home life, which is what you would get with Tiger. But yeah, the inclusion of Tiger in one of these seasons is, that's the holy grail.
No, dude, you know what though? This is, I'm so disappointed in your takes today. Because you've been a long-standing guy of golf needs to get away from having Tiger as the savior. And honestly, like Tiger has been profiled and done to death. Like if you want to know stuff about Tiger Woods, like go read Wright Thompson. You'll get like a very good introspective look into Tiger Woods. Go watch the series that's out on, what is it, HBO that did the Tiger Woods doc, the most recent one? Who did that? The one that you and I watched and discussed, actually.
About him and his dad?
Yeah, it was like, there's lots of Tiger Woods profile. This, to me, is, hey, can you make golf interesting for the next generation of fans? Like, yeah, it was an HBO show. Can you make these golfers more interesting, compelling, and how do we get that? Rivalries. What is sport missing right now? Yeah, hate.
What? It's golf. You can't, like, honestly, you look at the JT Jordan Spieth thing, that is literally as close to a rivalry as you'll get.
Except
because
for
these guys do, they make too much money, and it's too awesome to go out week after week and play golf.
Like, no, but that's
You can't, you can't just manufacture it. Like, maybe we'll see that this year when it's, like, the first full season of LIV, right? And the only time we see these guys come together will be at these major tournaments. Like, man, this year's Masters is going to be super interesting, I think. But yeah, no, outside of Patrick Reed and Rory McIlroy, like who, and Phil and Tiger, obviously. But yeah, no, there are.
If it wasn't there, fine. I think that it was. To me, one of the beautiful things about the show and one of the great things about golf in general, like getting to know these people, is how hyper competitive that they are. And that knowing, you're right. They showcase these stories of the people who are friendly with each other, like the two Chilean guys and Spieth and Thomas, where, I really don't care about these guys' dynamic and relationship because they're not forthcoming and they're not saying anything interesting. Like, I think one of the most cringeworthy moments in all of television history now is Jordan Spieth calling Justin Thomas to be like, you have any advice for my wedding speech? And he's like, just be yourself. I'm like, wow, what a great moment between two very close friends. I think that that is there. I think that you saw that with Rory. I think that you can get those biting moments where those guys are pissed off at each other, where there was going to be something. And it was only through Rory. The one guy who's already publicly outspoken about LIV Golf, the one guy who has positioned himself forward-facing with the PGA and against these guys, we got quotes from him. Great. We already really knew his position. He's already kind of been out there with basically everything he said. A lot of the sound that they use in the show is them at podiums. And I'm going like, great. We're just seeing podiums that no one cared to watch before. How about the embedded element to this? How about the private trash talking? And I was disappointed that all we ended up getting from guys, like, why is Fitzpatrick saying, oh, they gave me a half-hearted offer, it wasn't anything serious, and that's the only comment you're giving on LIV Golf? Like, that sucks. That's disappointing.
Don't that little child.
Sell it. Don't sell it as LIV versus PGA. Don't sell it as a production company that thrived off of building a sport out of drama. Again, people don't care about the cars going around and on the track. That's not why they watch the F1 series. They watch the F1 series because of the dynamic between the drivers and the team principals and the openness in which they were willing to share their animosity towards one another, their jealousies towards one another.
It's the nature of the sport, though.
I think the nature of golf is that, too.
You compete against the other players, but truly it's just you, right? Like
yep.
You don't hit your ball into somebody in a golf tournament. You just play your own ball. And yes, at the end of the day, was your score better than somebody else's? But it's not like somebody can do something to impact what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
And those instances are so few and far between, and they almost all involve Patrick Reed. So, like, yeah, because everybody hates Patrick Reed. So I guess if Patrick Reed was a part of the next season, maybe you'd have a little bit of that. But it's just the nature of the sport. It's competition, but it's really just these individuals going out and playing golf. There's not even the team element, which you got out of Drive to Survive, right? Where it's like, hey, who's the number one driver? That was the biggest drama. It wasn't even necessarily guys that were on different teams. It was guys within the same team and the dynamic of being the number one driver or feeling disrespected by your team principal. There is no element of that in golf. And anything that attempts to create that would feel disingenuous.
Well, I'll just tell you this. That's what they were going for when they try to get this series. They want growth
sure,
in their game.
If it existed.
F1, when you're like, oh, it didn't grow. It was late. It was slow burn. Actually, it jumped just in like the States by 18% after the first year. You think that there's going to be an 18% jump in golf? There was a 54% increase by season two. So, yeah, I don't think that golf is going to have that ripple effect. And that is how I'm judging this. If this was just like, we wouldn't be talking.
Starting at a different level with F1, though, right? Like, obviously, F1 was a very secondary sport in the United States. So it had, there's a lot more room to grow for F1 than there is professional golf in the United States.
I mean, yeah, it's a pretty small number, I guess. But it started with over 500,000 people that were watching every event.
Yeah, which is, in the United States, that's nothing.
Yeah, but if you compare it to, say, like a baseball game, what do you think the odd baseball game is doing television-wise in the States? Over 1 million?
Oh, yeah. There's almost 400 million people in the United States.
I know. What do you think the average baseball game
does? I mean, we can make fun of baseball, and we've done that plenty, and the average viewer being, whatever, 57 years old or whatever. It was outrating Formula One.
My point is, we wouldn't be talking about this series if it wasn't supposed to be expansion of the game. I don't care about the storytelling of most of these golfers. Like, ultimately, yes, I really enjoyed the Joel 100%. Damon one. It was awesome as a viewer, as a sports fan, as somebody who, gives a crap about.
But he doesn't grow the game because he's Joel Damon, and he shot like 4 over yesterday.
That's it. And I've been like, what is going to grow the game, and I view this across all of sports, is better storytelling, understanding the characters better. I think that this documentary did a pretty decent job at that. Like, we do get to know some of these guys better. I'm more of a Tony Finau guy after watching him, right? Mm-hmm. I'm more of a Rory McIlroy guy after watching Rory. I'm less of a Liv guy. So there's little impacts on somebody like me who's already going to be paying attention through sport. I'm saying if I sat down with someone and they had really no interest in golf, would they now be wanting to watch more of it? Would they want to sit down like you and I with F1? Would they care about these rivalries? I do not think so. That's the scale I'm judging this on. Again, I don't care. Maybe I shouldn't have done this with you because you are too big of a golf fan.
No, but like, I can give you anecdotal evidence that what you said is incorrect, because my wife watched the whole thing. Like, she was maybe not riveted, but she was like, I'm enjoying this. I really like this.
Sure. I'm sure she enjoyed it. You think she's going to want to watch golf now?
I have no idea. We'll find out, because I'm going to put it on today before I go to work.
Let's see how that goes. Be like, Joel Damon's up. She'll be like, that's nice. I hope he wins. Like,
last chance to see him, because he's not making the cut.
I'm going to go through a couple of my other like wins and losses and gripes. You can just cut me off in spots that you want to jump in. I really didn't like the narration of the show. I thought that was actually another thing between that and the F1 show, is we had Will Buxton for F1, and he's kind of this like fearless storyteller who's very embedded in the world of F1, and he basically has the ability to say whatever he wants. He's there, he knows what's going on, and he's not afraid of like pissing somebody off by saying the story the way that he perceives it. The narration in this show was pretty garbage, and it was a bunch of people who, like, if you are deeply a golf fan, you kind of know who they are. But for the most part, it's like, sorry, how did they choose these people? And for the most part, it was like the same people saying the same thing over and over again, which is that, like, we had the one person going, it's very hard to win on the PGA Tour. I'm like, great, thanks. I need this 45 times.
Amanda Balayonis is like a huge name, but yeah, no, I don't know if it was the things that she was given to say, because that's another thing, is right. Like, it's a reality show, but like the creators are are obviously trying to shape a narrative, and
that's it,
telling these people what direction the episode is going in. And as much as I love Dylan Dettier and Dan Rapoport, who I guess now follow on Twitter, those they're not the biggest names in golf journalism.
Yeah, our friend Sam McKee texted me. Did our friend Michael Collins die? Like, he would have been perfect for this series.
100%. You see him in the background. Who is, like, Rick Ross? Is that, like, one of the golf tournaments in one of the final episodes? You see him next to him, like, explaining what's happening at the golf tournament. But, yeah, no, he would have absolutely been an amazing add to the show. I don't know why he's not there.
I think Brooks Koepka is extremely important to golf, and there is a story that he has a bit of buyer's remorse with Liv, that he is healthy right now, and that he is uber competitive, and that he might be the first guy to leave Liv. In that case, that will make a compelling story in season two, because I think that Brooks Koepka was maybe the most interesting guy on the show outside of Rory, just from the standpoint of he's really not afraid to say stuff. And yeah, he kind of just owns being the big golf douche robot, but you could tell that he's pretty fearless in the things that he'll say. And
oh, yeah.
I thought
the Phoenix Open, he's like, it almost feels like a real sport.
Exactly.
Here.
I like that. But that doesn't really work, all the Brooks Koepka stuff, when he's not the man. You know, it just becomes kind of, who really cares what this guy's saying? And Brooks sort of, I think a big mistake for him from a public standpoint was when he did this stuff with Bryson, because at first it was funny, but then he took it so far that it became lame, and it felt like if it feels like you're bullying Bryson DeChambeau, you know you've gone too far, right? Like, you want to talk about a guy who you thought was unbullyable, it was him, and then Brooks Koepka found a way to make it seem lame to do that. But I think that he's one of the most interesting guys in golf. I think he's one of the most important guys in golf. He clearly cares. Like I said, he's a bit of a douche, but he knows it, and he's very unfiltered in the way that he acts. He's different. He stands out. There's an aura about him. And I really do think that if he leaves Liv, comes back to the PGA, and they can get that documented on the next season of the show, that would be by far the highlight of the entire thing.
Well, yeah, I want to see him like fork over hundreds of millions of dollars to the Saudi government. That's rough.
I'm just saying, apparently he's a hardcore competitive guy, and I thought that you got that in the
sense.
Show. The way that he was talking about Scottie Scheffler, you could tell like Scottie had become him.
Yeah. No, I just sent you an Instagram DM of, because I was going through Brooks Koepka's Instagram post, and he had one that was like promoing the new season of Live Golf, and like all the team captains of all the horribly named teams, like trying to act cool. And this is a guy who, is not old, like has not moved past his prime.
Yeah.
Being a part of that, I would imagine there's some buyer's remorse there. Also, to a different degree, but he is like kind of an encapsulation of the general golfer, at least I can put my hand up and say, like, the me type golfer. Like, he felt embarrassed because he played poorly. You can play super well for like years and years and years, and then all of a sudden you just lose it because you're in your head and you're like, how do I stop thinking?
Yeah.
Like, I know, I thought Brooks was, and always have thought Brooks is one of the more interesting guys.
Yeah, I thought his episode, if I was ranking the episodes in terms of best to worst, I would say 8 was the best, but 2 was my second favorite, just simply because of Brooks. The episode 3, where I think this was already public information, but just another reminder that Tiger Woods turned down $700 million from Liv.
Yeah.
$700 million. I just sit with that number just for a second, everyone listening to this. What $700 million is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a lot of money. And, Dylan actually brought up a good point yesterday when I was talking to him that, part of...
Boy, you should do a show with Dylan, because he really seems to shape all your takes. But anyways, let's continue.
I mentioned a take I gave him, but the point he made about how staunch Tiger is in his defense of the PGA Tour has to do with his own legacy, and that any little bit of prestige that is taken away from the PGA Tour takes away from like everything that he's done, and like his whole Wikipedia page, like if it gets like watered down even a little bit, is obviously hurtful to the greatest golfer we've ever seen.
I thought that the toughest look of the show, outside of Ian Poulter saying, I didn't cover my expenses, as he's boarding a private jet and saying he did it for his family, was like, okay. That was a pretty, like, Ian Poulter, the biggest loser of the show in terms of the way he's perceived. I don't think, I think anybody who watched that, they'll never view him sympathetically ever again. But the toughest look of the entire show is the journalist who asks the question about the LIV golfers sitting at a panel. It's DJ and it's Louis Oosthuizen. And they're sitting there at a panel, and the journalist outlines all of the human rights violations in Saudi Arabia and how LIV golf impacts those things. And they all snicker and laugh. And I thought that, like, you and I have talked a lot about, hey, the degrees in which these guys are criticized for going to live for this kind of money, and how, like, there's a lot of people who are hypocritical who wouldn't do this. And even, again, some of the people on the PGA that are not doing it for moral reasons as much as they are doing it for legacy purposes and for selfish ends. But that little clip did change. Like, there's no coming back from that clip for me of DJ snickering and laughing at that as they're telling him about, people being murdered. I was like, yeah, that was pretty soulless moment, pretty tough moment.
Yeah, and if you're him, you're like, I'm snickering because, like, I'm an athlete, and that's not a question. But, yeah, no, you have to understand.
No, but there was a question. The question was how did they feel this was helping? Because that was one of the positions, was they were, like, trying to take this weird position at one point of, well, this is actually golf is, like, Phil has this horrible moment in the show, too, where he goes, I believe in the power of golf. I'm like, are you serious? Like, are you really doing this right now?
To bring people back from the dead.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, to bring people back from the dead.
No, yeah. We know what it's about. It's about the money. And yes, and there's horrible players at the very top of North American pro golf, too. Like, that's a reality.
Again.
Probably not as bad as the ones that are the stakeholders in the LIV Tour, but yeah, just be upfront with it.
Like, yeah.
And Phil, he ruined everything, right? Like, out of the chute, putting everything on the table with his comments that he thought were off the record.
That's
like,
still so funny, though, that was even a position he took. He was like, I thought those comments were off the record. It's like, they're out
to
there.
To a journalist.
Yeah, like, but not only that, it's like, they're out there. That's your defense, is like, you were screwed over by saying, anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Like, you still said them.
Yeah.
Right?
This wasn't something like Joe Thornton, where someone in the locker room took a quote of him saying something a little bit, blue. This is like a guy going, yeah, we know exactly what's going on. We don't care.
Did we miss the part that right before that you're like, what I'm about to say is the opposite of how I feel?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the only reason that this could be justified. Anyway, I would give the series, in terms of like me enjoying it, a solid 7 out of 10. Like, again, I enjoyed watching it. I got through every episode. I thought that, there was a real lull 6 and 7 with the Finau stuff and then the rookies on tour. It was just, it got into basic storytelling where it's like, here's the adversity and then here's the kind of triumph, but it wasn't enough, and I was like,
adversity. Well, adversity, the poor rookies who making hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, that was exactly. And I was like,
I mean, I know poor Thigala, he blew a lead at the WM Phoenix Open. It's like, he's devastated. He won $400,000, one of his first tournaments on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, I know. It was just, that's it. That was it. It was like, it didn't really hit that way. So outside of those two episodes and the first one, I'd say, if you nail 5 of the 8 episodes, and I really enjoy 5 of the 8, then you did a good job. And it sets up where there's potential for season 2. I just, like I said, I really want to see sports grow. I always want to be able to talk about these things, because this makes for our jobs to be way more fun when people are in on this stuff and they're in on the drama and they're interested in the stories. And I will keep harping on this. I really think what is missing in the sports world right now, and what F1 tapped into, is that there aren't enough rivalries, there isn't enough hate, and that sports have gotten too friendly and too cookie cutter in a lot of ways, where a lot of things are the same and they get sold the same and blah, 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 blah. And golf had this chance to really do something with this massive story, and I feel like they got close to it, they kept approaching it, and then when it was time to really do something about it, they kind of missed their shot. So maybe season 2.
Yeah, I would say that, man, just you saying that and then me applying it to golf, and already I've made my position known that I don't think that enough of that exists in golf to expect it. But man, think about what this show, if given all access to the NBA, what it would look like, or all access to the NFL, and an Eli Apple episode. Like, there's so much more ground that they could be covering in the world of pro sports.
Buddy, I said this yesterday. I was like, why do we know who Eli Apple is? Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Why do we care about Patrick Beverley? Mm-hmm. It's like, these are the guys that are standing out because they're the ones who are caring and not afraid to be villains. And we need more sports villains. And it's why, I was kind of hoping Phil would actually be more involved in the show, and how good episode 8 would have been had they've been doing Rory's side, but also Phil's side, split across from it, but they just didn't really have access to
and
Phil.
And you would think that LIV Tour would be pushing Phil to be a part of it. Like, obviously, they went to him and asked him if he would do it.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyways, quick break. Let's come back and let's talk a little baseball.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, good hour continues with Ben Ennis of Fan Drive. My friend, I'm going to do a lot more baseball in the next hour. I've got John Morosi, and there's actually, he's down in spring, down in Dunedin. I don't know why, but I guess it's just, this is natural that once it becomes a reality, they become much bigger stories. But I am really curious to kind of hear his thoughts on how these rules are playing out and the ways that guys are discussing them. I'm like, what does a catcher's defense matter anymore, Ben, now that these bases are so big that it's like anybody can steal? Like, are we just going to see?
Well, no, I would say that part increases the importance of the catcher defense and being, because there's going to be more guys attempting to steal bases.
Yeah.
And I think like that's almost secondary, like the bigger bases where it's like 3 inches difference, which is not
nothing. No, they look much bigger. They look double the size. They're stacking the bases on top of each other. What, you think that's an optical illusion?
No, you're looking at there's a couple of joke tweet pictures.
No, I'm not looking at the joke ones. I'm looking at the ones that were tweeted by reporters.
Literally 3 inches bigger.
Yeah.
Which is not nothing.
Yeah, they look huge.
But I think the bigger impact on the base stealing will be the pitch clock and the number of times that you can
you're allowed to throw back.
Off,
yeah,
right?
I know. Like, that's huge.
No, that's going to be big. No, and it's not just trying to catch base stealers too. It's going to be a lot of guys are going to be throwing behind base runners at first base, like catchers, because that's again a renewed importance in the game. No, I think there's that.
It's interesting that you think it's going to go that way. I feel like it's going to go the opposite, where teams concede far more frequently.
What do you mean? Like they just say, "Hey, take second base."
To certain players, yeah. I think that if you're a really good base stealer, like, yeah, you're not going to try to do that to the middle class of base stealers. And I thought about that with the Jays, too. They were showing sort of their guys and their roster. I saw a graphic of just their stolen base leaders from last year, and I went, do you think that they're really going to have a team that takes advantage of this enough?
No, you know what was shocking?
Yeah.
Blake pointed this out the other day. Blue Jays actually had an above-average number of steal attempts last year, which is like mind-blowing, because it felt like they never ran, because nobody runs in Major League Baseball. And it was kind of damning with faint praise. But yeah, no, I don't think the Blue Jays necessarily are going, outside of like maybe Bo Bichette, but let's also not forget your preseason take of
Vladdy would get 20.
You're going to steal 20 bases.
What did he get, 3?
I think he got 7.
Wow, that was close, actually. If he got 7, no way he got 7. Did he really?
I'm pretty sure he had 7.
No, maybe 7 attempts. Really? Okay, if I got 7, that's basically 20, honestly. That's the take was correct.
Do the math.
Yeah, do the math, exactly. That 7 is 20. 7 is the new 20.
How many? 8. Sorry, 8. I sold them short.
Honestly,
11 attempts, 8 steals.
How dare you try to bring that up as though that was a bad take for me. Anyway, okay, quickly here. You acknowledged it already on Twitter about, hey, the Corbin Burnes thing. For those of you that haven't heard it, hey, here's Corbin Burnes of the Milwaukee Brewers discussing his arbitration and how upset he was upon... Is it ready, Austin? We got it or what? Yeah, okay. Here's Corbin Burnes talking about how he's feeling after the arbitration process with the Brewers.
There's no denying that the relationship is definitely hurt from what perspired over the last couple weeks. There's really no way getting around that. Obviously, we're professionals and we're going to go out there and do our job and keep giving what I can every fifth day that I go out there. But when some of the things that are said that. For instance, basically put me in the forefront of the reason why we didn't make the postseason last year. I mean, that's something that probably doesn't need to be said. You know, we can go about a hearing without having to do that. So that's kind of one of those things that, obviously, there was no attacking of character of, person of who I was, but just the some of the stuff that was said that definitely didn't need to be said is something that I think kind of disappointed everyone.
Okay, so there's a couple things here. One is that
he said perspired instead of transpired.
Well, yeah, that's a move I would make. You know, that's a move that I would do a lot. The first thing that I really thought of with this was, this is how these guys interpret this stuff. When he went, they put me at the forefront as to why we didn't make the playoffs last year. You think the Brewers did that? Of course not. But that's the way that these uber competitive guys interpret these things. And I made the point weeks ago that that was the important thing with Bo Bichette, and that we need to stop doing the nerdy thing, which has become group speak amongst a lot of baseball people. I'm sorry, a lot of the hardcore baseball people, they love to tell you that arbitration doesn't matter and it is just business, and at the end of the day, money is what matters. These guys, blah, 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 blah. It's not true. There's no way that it's true. It's not a blanket statement. Is that the case for probably the majority of the guys? Absolutely it is. But there are certain personalities that it is going to impact in different ways. We brought up Marcus Stroman before. I really think Bo Bichette would have been one of those guys. And I'm very, very pleased that the Jays did get ahead of it, because I wouldn't be shocked if we would have gotten maybe not something as strong as this. This is the strongest media.
We're also talking about a joke organization in the Brewers, right, who are like in a playoff chase. And yeah, I know, yeah, Josh Hader wasn't having a great year, but they're like, yeah, let's cast off good players,
yeah,
because, you know, we play in a, I guess, a tiny market, and we don't want to compete with the big boys, even though everybody, every owner in Major League Baseball, every billionaire owner has the financial wherewithal to.
But these guys all do this, right?
Competitive. Yeah, but no, the Brewers are. Listen, they've just basically said, we've alienated a guy who won the Cy Young Award 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, this is, it's a ridiculous move.
Yeah, it's really, really bad.
Over $700,000.
Yep. I know. It's so, it's when you put it that way, it's so, so bad. Like, imagine being a fan of that team going, how much money did we save and who are we using the money on? And they're like, well, they saved 700 Nothing. Grand and it won't go to anyone. Nobody. And you're like, oh, very good. You know, like, that's a tough part of the story. That's not great.
Maybe refurbish Bernie Brewer's slide.
Yeah, that's not great. Yeah, that is not a good one. Okay, so yeah, before you go, and we'll talk a lot during spring training, obviously, but is there something in particular that you have an interest in the early days of spring? Because to me, it's basically all just the impact of the rule changes on the guys.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. And yeah, obviously, the Kevin Gausman, like, figuring out how to pitch again. Like,
I got to say, it's mildly concerning to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, man, we know how much professional athletes are creatures of habit, and he has established himself as one of the best pitchers in baseball, like doing things a certain way over the last near half decade, and now we're telling him, okay, I know you relearned how to pitch and took yourself off the scrap heap and maybe like on the verge of being out of Major League Baseball to one of the best pitchers in all of baseball.
I don't need this. You're getting me too afraid, because I was already a little afraid and I was trying to have it be unspoken. But yeah, no, it's a real thing for me.
Oh, my favorite. I mean, we already got a storyline yesterday, and it's a classic spring training storyline.
Springer healthier than ever.
What's that?
Springer in the best shape of his life, healthier than
ever. No, but it is like along that
Kikuchi
line. I mean, how many times did we see like, hey, laser Romano eye surgery, I'm seeing the ball now.
Yeah.
No, it's Yusei Kikuchi.
Yeah.
Made a bunch of changes. Mm-hmm. They're really excited about Yusei Kikuchi, and they've already like planted the seed that Mitch White has a bit of an injury. He's like a little
he does.
Bit behind.
Shoulder impingement.
Yeah. So he's behind. So they can stash him on the injured list to start the year.
Yeah,
because he's out of options, so he won't be on the Blue Jays 26-man roster.
Blake's favorite player, Mitch White.
Yeah,
so handsome, people believed that he was actually dating Margot Robbie. Yeah, I know you did. I saw you fall for that. You try to accuse me of falling for the giant bases, and here you are.
No, you once fell for a clickhole article.
Yeah, about Fox.
Claimed that the first the Buzz Aldrin saw like a fox on the moon.
Yeah, I did fall for that. I did see that, and I saw it, and I was like, did you see Buzz Aldrin so crazy? He thought he saw a fox on the moon. Ben's like, yeah, it's a clickable article. I was like, ooh, it's tough look for me. It's a tough look. I got caught. But you know what, though? That just shows you how little I get caught, is that I got caught one time, and it's legendary around the office. Anyway, yeah, I saw the Kikuchi stuff. That's pretty stock and standard. These are the spring training stories that you can always have. Guy who didn't walk enough got a pitching machine. And is going to be more selective at the plate. Guy who's always hurt actually is very healthy this year and not afraid of getting hurt. And guy who sucked last year has been making an adjustment, and there's a lot of excitement around that player. That's pretty much – or and also guy who is in his early to mid-20s is now taking a step as a leader.
That's right.
Is now taking more ownership over the clubhouse.
I mean, that's an overarching narrative around the entire team. It's like they've matured. They've suffered their bumps.
Maturing. What else? We should have done a free agent or a spring training bingo. And and the journeyman type of player that is kind of a fringy roster guy that might not even actually end up on the team is like really exciting people and looking like he could throw back to the player that he once was.
Dude, but, you know, I was thinking about one of those narratives you said, like, hey, the guy who doesn't walk and is has horrible plate discipline is learning how to do that, and how many times you did that about Kevin Pillar. One of the guys that actually, like, the few guys that I can ever remember doing that in Major League Baseball retired yesterday. Eric Thames was, like, swing at everything when he was a member of the Blue Jays and then the Mariners and then went to Korea and then came back and made himself almost $20 million but on the strength of being more selective.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is an example, at least, out there for people to look at. Like, going across the Pacific Ocean. But, yeah, he figured it out.
Good for him. Didn't know he retired yesterday. All right. I was going to talk to you about World Baseball Classic and why we don't care, but maybe that'll be a next week thing. We got plenty of time before World Baseball Classic.
Stay tuned for that, why we don't care.
Yeah. Well, it's like, why do we don't have more pressure on the athletes kind of thing? It is a little strange that we care. So, like, basically my position there is just simply we roast Canada basketball when those guys don't show up at events. And then Canada baseball, who also has a ton of talent, it's like, hey, congrats to Andrew Albers and, you know, who continues to just be on these teams, just like in perpetuity. John Axford,
too. Dempster today. I'm sure got a phone call. It's like, how old is anything left in the tank?
How old is John Axford now? 43, 42?
Yeah,
he's... maybe he's not that old. Maybe I've aged him too much. But yeah, it's like it feels like he's been out of baseball now for a little while, and here he was back to
Eric Gagne pitched at like 1,000.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean. If you're on a Canadian baseball pitcher, it's like they'll keep you.
Axford's 39.
Okay, my bad, Ax. So my bad. Yeah, I know.
He's young. He's just a young
spry. Anyways, bye, Ben Ennis. I'll see you later. Up next, John Morosi. We'll check in on spring and all those stories that I just teased.
Hey, it's Ben.
All right, the bad vibes are over, all right? Ben is gone. Whew, thank God. Horrible takes from him today. Just genuinely awful. Guys, there's no comp. They couldn't have done any better with the golf. Wrong. Patricia. Wrong. It was just a parade of wrong. A man who will change things, though. A light in the darkness that is today. Winter returning. John Morosi from Dunedin. What's up, pal? How we doing?
Good morning, JD. Yes, I am in beautiful Dunedin, Florida. I love being around the Jays so much that after yesterday, spending the day at the Player Development Complex, I returned this morning to make sure I had even more time with the Jays. So I'm very excited.
Yeah, it'd be kind of weird if you went down there and didn't spend any time around the Jays. Gotta say.
Well, that's why I spent not one but 2 days, and then I'm flying back to Michigan and our beautiful northern cold climate today. But I'm excited to be able to share a little more sunshine with you here right now.
Okay, so I was just joking about how spring training, there's a lot of narratives, right, that usually once you start doing this a long time, you get used to the beats of it, right? So we had one, which is Yusei Kikuchi, the pitcher who stunk the year before, and now they're excited about him turning it around. There's usually a guy who struggled at the dish, and maybe he got like a pitching machine or some kind of adjustment, laser eye, who knows what it is, but is going to make adjustments at the plate this year. There's the injured player who gets hurt all the time, but this year they're healthier than ever. There's a person who is in the best shape of their life usually. A lot of trying to sift through, you know, the ways that guys want to portray themselves at this time of year. But is there something about the Blue Jays, like you're down there, that did stick out to you where you went, huh, this does feel a little different or this is noticeable?
Yes. This team right now, JD, is going to be my pick to win the American League East. I believe this is a division winner. I look at, for a number of reasons, I believe Berríos will be better this year. Okay. He is reported. I saw him today and yesterday. It looks like he's in phenomenal shape. of course, he's really, and I talked to Chris Bassett yesterday about this, and Chris thinks that Berríos is probably a good week ahead of everybody else because he's got to get ready to pitch for Puerto Rico in the Classic. And I think that's one of the things that we hear so much about, you know, teams occasionally being concerned about their pitchers going to the Classic. In the case of Berríos, I think he's ready. He's ready, ahead of schedule, feeling great, because he knows how important the tournament is. So I think he's going to use the Classic as a catapult to having a really good season. I think that he, in my view, is much more important getting the best version out of him than necessarily focusing on what the bounce back looks like for Kikuchi, if there is going to be one. I think it's great if he does bounce back, but Kikuchi is probably a 4 to 5 inning fifth starter.
Right.
Berríos is, when he's right, your co-ace with Manoah and Gausman, and Bassett can pitch like an ace. So I see a clear line, the top four starters in the fifth spot. There's been some positive buzz around Zach Thompson as well. So I focus much more on Berríos than Kikuchi or anyone else, because Berríos, to me, is the difference maker for this team.
Yeah, that's huge, if he can be that. And, yeah, I think he's sort of – maybe he won't be at this point, but I do think that he was one of, like, the forgotten guys the offseason to a certain degree. Like, people have, I don't know, seemingly, I would say, written him off a bit, or that they don't have the same expectations that they did of him just even a year ago, where he was the opening day starter. This is a bit of a deviation, but I did want to talk to you about the World Baseball Classic, so I'm just going to go there now, and we'll come back to spring. You sure. mentioned how teams don't really love their pitchers going. I think I was reading, I can't remember if it was Shy or who was yesterday, I read a ton on the Jays camp, and there was just a note from one of the people I was writing of, hey, the Blue Jays are probably pretty excited that Romano is not going for Italy. And I'm excited, too, because, God, it drives me nuts that he does that. And two is that Manoah is not going for the States, and that they were, you know, like, probably pretty happy about that. What's your understanding of the level of pressure organizations put on players and asking them not to go to this tournament?
It's a great question. I think it is lessened over time. The commissioner actually spoke with us yesterday, and he said that that there are fewer instances in which there have been conversations and complaints made by players about organizations trying to persuade them to not participate. Uh-huh. There are occasionally some ways in which organizations can say, well, if you leave, then we're not watching you, and if you're on the bubble to make the team, you might be hurting your chances to make it, and there's sort of that sort of soft pressure, if you will, or maybe it's not so soft.
That's not soft. The other side, you might not have a job. It's pretty intense.
So the other side of it, right, the other side of it can be more of an incentive to say, hey, if you stay in camp, we can work a bit more on your long-term contract extension. We'd like you to be around so you can take your physical. We can keep an eye on you. You know, so some of that happens too. Is it coercion, so to speak? Perhaps in some ways, but I think it's less frequent now than it used to be. We saw the 2017 season, I believe, Stroman pitched in the Classic and then went out and threw 200 innings for the Jays. So I think that it really is individual dependent. I think more and more players want to compete. I believe the Jays are going to be thrilled at the way that Berríos pitches after the Classic. I believe they're going to be happy with the way that Vlad performs after the Classic. You know, there is such intensity and pressure in pitching in this event that when you come back from your national team to go to your camp, it's almost like the pressure seems like it's less when you rejoin your club, because you're basically playing postseason games in March. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a way that it gets you locked in. So specifically, how would the Jays feel about Manoah or Romano pitching? I'm a believer that if Manoah had pitched, I saw him yesterday, he looks great physically. Mm-hmm. I think he would have been able to withstand the demands of pitching for his country. But I understand that not everyone is the same. And for some people, especially for Manoah, given his innings increase in last season, maybe a little bit more of a chill March was what was needed. I happen to think that for Aaron Judge, he went through so much physically and mentally last year to set the record. And then, of course, just I think he frankly ran out of gas in the postseason. I think having a March for him in Yankees camp is probably advantageous. Yeah. But not everyone is the same. And I think for the Jays, they're going to benefit from Vlad and Jose having competed for their teams.
Yeah, I don't have an issue with dudes who decide that it is in their best interest to stay, especially ahead of a grueling baseball season. I do want to have a conversation at some point on this podcast about, hey, why is it that we as Canadians really care about athletes not showing up in some sports but not for this event? Is it just because of the infancy or whatever the hell it is? But yeah, it isn't just it's an interesting one to me that, like, I've never really been aware of what a priority the World Baseball Classic is to Major League Baseball. Like, obviously, they're in partnership with the event. Their athletes go to this thing. But where they see the growth potentials for this, how important they view this tournament, because it's like, yeah, there are some nations where guys really want to go, clearly, right? Like, Vladdy going, I think that's a pretty good indication of that group. There are other countries where it's like, eh, not so much. Canada seems to be a little bit on that, although I was pretty shocked to see Freddie Freeman going, where I went, oh, you're doing this again? All right, right on. Welcome. Welcome back, Freddie. We're stoked to have you. But yeah, it's never really been clear to me where they view the import of this event. And yeah, how much club pressure probably deters what is I still think a good opportunity for baseball to continue to grow around the world. Okay, so back to the Blue Jays. You mentioned that that Berrios sticks out to you, that the team looks good, the team looks like they're going to win the American League East to you. How vocal, just because you mentioned his name, how vocal, how big of a presence did you find Chris Bassitt to have already with that group?
Very strong. Yeah. I have a lot of admiration for Chris.
Yeah.
Yes. I have a lot of respect for him in his career. I mean, remember, he's been through a lot. He took the line drive off his face and came back and pitched later on in that season. I mean, he is a tough, hard-nosed, multi-sport athlete from a really small town in Ohio who has just grinded his way into having a great Major League career. You look at his consistency, what he's been able to do. I've been very, very impressed by him. And I think he's someone that his ability to go deep in games will make an extraordinary impact on this team consistently during the course of the season. I think as much as we talked about maybe ways in which the Jays pitching staff fell short last year and ways in which, and certainly we go back and scrutinize game two against Seattle a lot.
Yeah.
But the reality was, I think at different times in the year, you know, Gausman was going deep in games. Manoa was as well. And I just don't know if they had enough starts of seven innings or more to really save the bullpen and make sure that the bullpen was being used when John Schneider and before him Charlie Montoyo wanted to, as opposed to when they felt like they had to. And so by adding in one more legitimate arm in Swanson, and you're hoping to get certainly more consistency in Romano and continued consistency from Romano and Garcia as well, when you add in someone in Bassitt who takes such pride in getting your team to the sixth and often seventh inning, that has a tremendous impact on your team for the entire season. When you look at the sheer mass of it, JD, if you have four starters that give you length and quality, then this circles back to what I said about Yusei Kikuchi earlier on in the season. It's great if he gives you six innings, but you don't need him to. You need more like 4 to 5 innings from him. And for someone that has at times struggled to throw strikes, that's a good bar to have. To say, you say, if you throw 4 and 2/3 and 2 earned, we're good with that. Because on the other 4 days, the other guys are giving us 6 and 7 innings. You can handle one bullpen sort of day,
yeah,
which is what Kikuchi can give you. And so that's where, in a sort of roundabout way, Chris Bassitt makes Kikuchi better, because you can more frequently embrace and be happy with what Kikuchi more often gives you, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think Bassitt really gives you both the mentality and the performance of a really reliable guy. And I think that he is very quickly going to become a fan favorite in Toronto because of the mentality and the pitch making that he delivers.
Yeah, demeanor too, just everything about the guy, yeah, screams fan favorite. And he was that with the Mets too. It's not going to be a surprise when that translates to here in Toronto, especially like if he just like, I mean, you got to pitch well, but I expect him to do that. It is interesting with this group though, too, right? You mentioned is like, hey, they feel like a favorite. You're watching them and yeah, guys like Barrios coming in. It's a reminder of like the pitching staff can have four nasty guys that go deep in ball games. The bullpen's deep. Like there's just a lot of reasons to believe that this team is going to be really good. But yeah, I am kind of curious as just like the conversations that you're picking up around the team and just like, What is being discussed with this group the most? Like, I'm take Barrios as one, but after him, what are sort of the things that are, like, the positive indicators to you about a camp that make you feel really good about a group outside of, like, who they are on paper?
I think a couple of things stand out. Number one, there's good leadership from the players. I think they've added some really good veterans, whether it's Kiermaier. I'm a big fan of Dalton Varsho. I think Brandon Belt's a really good addition. They've added some really professional guys that I think will help carry this young core through. And I still think it's important to point out that in both Vlad and Bo, you've got young veterans. They are the guys that drive the bus, but they're also in that sweet spot of still having the youthful energy of a young player, but the experience of a veteran, which is why this is a win now team. And you've got pieces around you that to me emphasize win now. Belt has got World Series rings. I think he is going to bring a lot to this team. Left-handed bat, again, a big part of that. Kiermaier is an absolute pro who I talked to him today, this morning. He sounds great. He talked to me about just how his hip after having surgery last year, how he was basically playing hurt for a number of years, and now he's in a much better physical space. The other part of this that I think is important to point out, this team, JD, has the type of personnel to win in this new baseball. I think Bo is someone that I think has worked on his range. You talked to me about working on his backhand. I think he's going to be able to cover shortstop. You've got an elite defender in Matt Chapman, and in this post-shifting universe, they've got the guys to handle the demands of the way that sports going to play. You have George Springer, a healthier version of him. And all this to me adds up to a team, and this is something we don't talk about enough in baseball, that's going to run the bases very well. The bases are bigger, of course. You're going to be able to see more stolen bases because of the throwover rules and the actual physical size of the base. Kiermaier is a base stealer. Whit Merrifield is a base stealer. Biggio can steal bases. Varsho is a good athlete who runs the base as well. Springer is a good base stealer and can run the base as well. Mm-hmm. So I like Jansen runs the base as well for a catcher. You start adding up, and this is a team that I believe is going to take advantage of the new baseball, the new mode of the game in which it's played. And so I look at there may be some teams that struggle with it. I think this team's going to handle it very well, and you're going to see a team that creates offense and creates runs on the bases. And that's going to be, I think, of paramount importance in baseball in 2023.
Yeah, I do want to get to some of the rule change things, but, well, there's a whole bunch there that was interesting. One, I've never really worried about Bo Bichette's range. I think it's after he gets it, what he does with it. That's going to be the issue. Two, Springer, I saw in his last media availability, I watched it. He said, it feels good to feel good over and over and over again. Like, multiple times he kept saying that. I will say that one of my nervous points with this team is that, Springer's 33 years old, and he is already talking about his health, because that is going to be a major storyline this season. And Kiermaier talking about the hip, like you mentioned last year, how, like, a lot of aging guys love using that, right? They go, well, I stunk before because I was hurt and now I'm healthy. But yeah, the general human condition is not you get older and you start to feel better and you're less injury prone than you were before. Right. But yeah, what is your understanding sort of George Springer's health? And yeah, this team's confidence level that they are going to be able to keep him healthy, or that there is going to be a bit of a different approach from him this year. Because the outfield isn't like five guys deep, you know? We're still trying to wonder who's going to fill some of these spots for him when he's either DHing or he's getting rest days.
Right. Well, a couple of things. Number one, I think Merrifield's versatility is going to be important. I would expect that you'll see more potentially. Now, it depends on how the second base job plays out with Espinal and others. But I think you may see more Merrifield in the outfield than you see Merrifield on the infield. And that's because second base could be a combination. Maybe it's Espinal, maybe it's Biggio, maybe it's Otto Lopez getting involved there. And then Merrifield becomes more of an outfielder. I think that's very possible. The other part of this is George is going to be a right fielder now. And I think that he is someone who has always played so hard and is such a committed player that sort of almost by design limiting the amount that he's going to be running and crashing into walls by playing right field is just a better it's a better way of taking care of him. And you also have in both Kiermaier and Varsho guys who can play center field. So that it's not even a thought, really, yeah. to put more stress on George. So I think George, to me, it was apparent that he was grinding through some pretty significant elbow issues last year. I mean, just the amount of times that he would wince. I mean, I remember I was in Toronto, I think it was middle of the year. I was around the trade deadline. I was at the ballpark, and George had what looked to be like three bowling balls worth of ice on his elbow in July. So, I mean, like he was going through this for a while. I just think that he seems to be in a great frame of mind. Again, looks good, sounds good. And there are, to your point, with older baseball players or athletes, there are things that are older guy injuries that are fixable,
yeah,
and those that are not. You look at Justin Verlander. He had Tommy John, looks great. George had bone chips in his elbow. That's something that's fixable. Kiermaier looked, when I talked to him today, Kevin's like, yeah, I got a new hip and I feel great. He's got a new hip. I mean, I at that point, you know, I'm no orthopedic surgeon, but if he's got a new hip and feels great, then one would assume he's got a few years on that new hip. So there are things that are more acute and more chronic. And I think that in the case of both Springer and KK, there were things that were fixed that were acute and they're now better. And, you know, Kevin was saying to me, you know, ideally you'd love to be a guy that plays in 162, but he said, I'm honest with myself. I'm 33. And if I play 140, that's probably a pretty good outcome. And you know what? I think he's right. Because if you've got Witt and if you've got Dalton, guys that can play center field, good. Let them play and take your days and know when it's time. And, you know, remember this about Kiermaier as well. He's been playing on turf his entire career. He knows how to deal with it, and he knows what it does to your body, but he also knows how to handle it. So I'm a big believer in Kevin Kiermaier, and I think he's a really good athlete who's going to find a way this year.
I would say to Kevin, though, hey, you've played over 140 once in your entire career, and that was 2015 when you were 25 years old. So maybe even drop that number further down because no one's expecting 140 from you. Like that's going to be that's a lot for Kevin Kiermaier. Okay, so the rules. The bases look big. Bobichet's trying to do backhands, and you're going to need to have a little bit more range defensively. I think that's pretty clear. But the one that really seems to be getting a lot of discussion already is Gausman and the pitch clock. Yeah, I gotta admit that there's enough conversation about this that I think that you're allowed to be a little concerned as a Blue Jays fan about it. Is that the biggest adjustment for the Blue Jays with the new rules, or is there something else that's coming up?
It's probably that. I think, you know, Gausman obviously is someone who is not among the quickest workers, we could say, in Major League Baseball. And yeah. So I think for him, that will be an adjustment. I think that it's going to be an adjustment for probably more of the relievers, because that's where, you know, starting pitchers, generally speaking, just in all my years of watching the game and following it, it always feels like starters have better tempo than relievers. A lot of relievers walk in and pitch out of the stretch. Obviously that's going to have to probably change a little bit. You're going to have to find guys that have the adaptability and athleticism to find a different routine. I think that they'll be able to do it on some level. I brought my wife last year to one game at Fenway, and it was a game that Luis Garcia pitched for Houston. And she said, this guy's got this coolest delivery I've ever seen. Like this whole rock the baby thing. And she's like, this is my new favorite pitcher. Well, he can't do it anymore. So there are probably some moments of individuality and character that we're going to lose because of the rules. I think the overall reason is a good one and one that's important. And honestly, I would have liked to have seen Gausman be available to pitch for the U.S. in the Classic, but of course the Classic is not going to use the new rules. And so if for the Jays, if the real effort here is to make sure that Kevin is comfortable with the new rules, then probably a good thing that he's going to stay in camp for 6 weeks.
Yeah, hadn't thought of that. Last one, non-Blue Jays related. Shohei Ohtani, you see his quote?
I did.
Yeah, I so did. For those that have not seen his quote, this is through an interpreter. Quote, "This is my last year, and I'm aware of that. As of now, I'm an angel, and that's all I want to focus on," end quote. I, as a sports fan of teams with pending free agents, if Austin Matthews said, "As of now, I'm a Maple Leaf," I would be not feeling great. I wouldn't love that quote. And again, through a translator, tone, whatever, it's a lot of different stuff. What's your understanding of the future of Shohei Ohtani here? Because, yeah, it's just beyond odd that you would walk a guy that is this caliber of player into a season without a contract extension.
Because of that exact reason, I have said before and continue to feel that I will be surprised if he's an Angel this time next year.
Uh-huh.
You can't rule it out because at the end of the day, Aaron Judge went to free agency and stayed a Yankee. But generally speaking, when you have a superstar who is this close to free agency and there's no real momentum around it, and you around an extension, and you have not made the playoffs since 2014,
mm-hmm.
the circumstances are not exactly moving you in a direction where you believe he's going to stay.
No.
For that reason, I have said before and believe strongly the Angels have the most pressure on them of any team in the major leagues to get off to a fast start.
Yep.
Period. Because every game they win is an incremental improvement in the chance that they at least keep Ohtani for the season and make a run with him in the playoffs. That's their metric. There is the standings, and there is the overarching 30,000 foot scoreboard, which says every win improves your chances of going to the 2023 playoffs with Ohtani, and every win also does a little bit more to convince him that he can win in Anaheim. Every loss, on the other hand, is one loss closer to potentially being a seller at the deadline and or increasing the amount of doubt in Ohtani's mind that you're going to ever be able to compete with him. And so that's an immense amount of pressure. Teams have had pressure in different ways. The Cubs had pressure in 2016 because that was their year to end the curse, and they did. That's one flavor of pressure. The Angels are dealing with pressure from a financial and existential standpoint that I'm not sure I've ever really seen before, which is every win is an essential component to keeping a talent the likes of which we have never seen before in Major League Yep. Baseball. And you're talking about a player, JD, who might ultimately earn $500 million in free agency.
Oh, you got to figure he gets
just
that.
The financial stakes of this are immense and quite literally without precedent in the history of the game.
Yeah. I mean, Trout's contract, I want to say, is over $400 million, right? So I got to figure Shohei is going to be able to get more than that. I find it shocking. Like, I was surprised. I thought he was definitely getting moved this offseason just because of that level of pressure that you're talking about. And yeah, if he's not going to make that commitment to you, I'm saying we've got to make sure that we recoup assets and we change our baseball team here. Because, yeah, losing Shohei at the – and, like, they would still get a haul for him at the deadline, right? Every team would want him to take a run. Of course. I understand these things. But, man, it just seems so risky, especially, like, if there was to be an injury that happened. And when I look at their division, I go, how are you supposed to leapfrog the Astros exactly? And, like, Seattle's been is taking another step this year, and they look like they're going to be competitive. A full year of Castillo. Now they're bringing in Teoscar. That bullpen's still nasty. Like, I don't have the Angels in the top two in their division. And yet they're still walking to this year with this position. And, okay, again, this is projecting so far forward, John. But what I think is kind of interesting about the Shohei thing is when you're saying they would become a seller, do you think they would ever get to a point, if that happens, if they move him, where they would also try and trade Mike Trout? Because he's 31 years old, man. And I have a hard time, even someone who has been as loyal to Anaheim and who is, or an Angel as much as he is, or whatever, that he would... yeah, just like play the rest of his career out on a loser.
It's a fair question. I don't see them trading Trout. I understand the argument and the mm-hmm. and the logic behind it. But remember, this is a team now that they're still trying to get a new ballpark there. The owner has just said, after exploring the possibility of a sale, that he's not selling. This franchise, even if at some point, well, let's even look at the ballpark element.
Yeah.
This team is more valuable and more marketable as a property to bring into a new stadium if you have Trout than if you don't. And if you and think about this team, if you lose Ohtani in free agency and you don't have Trout, what exactly is your identity?
Nothing.
And still, I realize Orange County is not L.A., but you're still in Southern California in a large, one of the largest population bases in North America. Who are you if you don't have Trout and Ohtani? And I think that's, they've got Rendon, but Rendon's been hurt.
Yeah, that's so a big drop off. We're the Ohtani Trout team to where the Rendon team is. So hard pivot.
Right. And listen, in fairness to Rendon, he's been an MVP candidate in the past, but he hasn't been that for a while.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to acknowledge that. And this is where, JD, and baseball is such a fun sport to talk about.
Yeah.
Because it's the one sport that we've got in our continent that does not have a salary cap. And so
yes, the best.
You really learn a lot about the priorities of teams and owners when you operate in a business like that.
Yeah. I just don't want to see Mike Trout's whole career go by without me ever watching him play an important game as Mike Trout. So
he's going to play important games this month for Team USA.
Sure.
JD, you're going to see Mike Trout face Team Canada in the same ballpark, JD, in the same ballpark where Team Canada pulled off the miracle on dirt, Adam Stern 2006. So you never know. You never know how that game's going to unfold.
Yeah. Bo Naylor. We're all very excited for Team Canada with Freddie Freeman.
Owen Casey. Casey, Bo Naylor, Freddie Freeman.
We're ready. John Morosi, you're the best. Thanks for coming on today, man.
My pleasure, JD. All the best. And I can't wait till the Wings eventually get back into relevancy so we can have a good Wings Leafs discussion. But that is not happening right now.
Me too. I did it on Leafs Talk maybe the last time they played. Is, to me, there is nothing more aesthetically pleasing from a jersey battle standpoint. There's Lakers-Celtics on Boston's court. That, to me, I'm like, whew, that's beautiful. And then there's Leafs-Red Wings, where it doesn't matter who's home or who's away. The blue and white versus the red and white. It just, there's something about it, the look of it. It feels right. We need it back. And if you want to talk about salary caps and how annoying they are, the NHL has become less and less relevant year over year because you can't make the special market special because of the stupid hard cap. Anyway, yes, someday, John.
Thanks, Diddy. I appreciate the conversation. All the best wishes to you, my friend.
See you, pal. John Morosi. Couple things off that. One, it is always funny to me where it's like 33-year-old guy's like, I got a new hip. I'm ready to play 140. Like, relax, Kevin. I always thought they were going to move Springer to right. Mm-hmm. It is always a point of curiosity, though. So Springer's 33 years old. It's old. So was Kevin Kiermaier. Old. Varsho. It wasn't sold immediately that he'd be the center fielder. I don't know why he's not just the center fielder and that the other guys are corner spots and that they can move over there. And yeah, maybe Kevin Kiermaier is still the better defensive player. So maybe you do give him a bunch of games in center, blah, 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 whatever. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand the justification for Springer playing center field anymore with these guys on the team. And when they acquired these guys, it still wasn't immediately like Springer is not the center fielder anymore. We'll see. Anyway, I'm very curious to see what he ends up playing there. The Angels story is fascinating to me. It's a nightmare for them entering the season. Like Shohei, again, they need a miracle. You're in the same division as two teams that are unquestionably better than you.
Yeah.
In the Mariners and the Astros.
Yes.
And all right, maybe you can be a wild card team, maybe, but it's going to take a lot. The teams in the American League that are definitely better than you, as of today, like no question, you're not favored to finish ahead of these teams. Yankees, Blue Jays, Rays, Cleveland, Houston, Seattle. The Angels won 73 games last year. Like, the idea that they are going to somehow jump up, 20 wins locks them into a playoff spot?
You may not even need like 93, 94 at this point.
Trout was injured for a bit there, though.
Who?
Trout.
Yeah, sure. Guess who's hurt every year now? Old Trout.
Yeah.
Trout's old.
Yeah.
I just don't see it. Like, I don't see how you're going to leapfrog all, like, none of the teams that I referenced that made the playoffs last year took a major step back. Who took a major step back?
None of them.
None.
Nope.
I think Chicago's going to be better. Minnesota brought in Correa.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Detroit, I think, will be a little bit more competitive this season than they were a year ago. Houston, Seattle really, really want to win. Texas is kind of more in the same vein as the Angels. Like, they're kind of there with each other, and Texas has spent more money, and they're trying to get good again. I don't know. I don't see how this ends well for Angels fans, and my hope is that Mike Trout asks out. I don't know if he ever would, and it's hard to ask out when you have you're still on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars. I think it's $35
million
a year.
$35.5 million a year.
Wow.
Yeah. Oof.
Yeah.
It's a lot of dough.
And I don't know how many teams even want to eat that money for Trout, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, that's such a – you're not – you're getting a really, really good baseball player. You're not getting the best baseball player on earth, which is who he was when he signed that deal. It's fascinating to me. Like, baseball is very much a sport where I think you really care about the local team, the local market. Who really cares until getting closer to the deadline about some of the national stories? But that is going to be like the Shohei Ohtani sweepstakes and watching the Angels and knowing what is going on with them on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
That is going to be a bit of a national story, I think, anyways, this year for baseball fans. Doesn't mean I'm staying up late and watching those games. All right, quick break. Let's come back. Let's wrap this sucker up and head into the weekend.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, fellas. Friday. Freezing cold. You two don't go outside anyway. Well, actually, Joe kind of does. You don't?
I go outside.
Pete's got a big weekend plan of Harry Potter video games. What did we miss? What do we got?
And Hawaiian vacation, I might add.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Flex on us some
I might add. He might add it. All right. You might add it. Eh?
So we had some nice Blue Jays news there from John Morosi, but some bad Yankees news coming out. Aaron Boone announcing that Frankie Montas was injured, shoulder injury. He'll require surgery and may miss the entire season.
This is all I have to say about this. Blue Jays tried to get that guy. Thank God, because everybody knew. This is one of those situations where pressure just makes general managers lose their minds because they go, God, if this guy could stay healthy. And that whenever you have to say that, if this guy could stay healthy, he'd be great. You're screwed. Frankie Montas is a Band-Aid. And the Yankees, a team. This is the thing about the Yankees, too. They're old. They're a really, really old team. Mm. They're a bunch of me's out there. What you want to have is a bunch of you guys is. Like, not physically you guys is, because you guys are, you know,
definitely
weak.
Not. I could hit something.
But, yeah. maybe.
I could get one hit.
If somebody wasn't looking.
If they threw me a looper, I think I could hit it.
Anyway, Yeah, the Yankees are old, and Montas already being hurt, and it's already a little bit of vibe of Yankees injuries, things not falling apart. That's why I worry about the outfield with the Blue Jays. It's like that's the spot where they got the old guys with new hips, and what did John Morosi say about Springer? Three bowling bags worth of ice on an elbow.
Yeah, bowling balls worth of ice.
Bowling bags.
Why did you say bowling bags?
I don't know. You put the bowling balls in the bowling bags, though. So.
They would be bigger than a bowling ball, so credit to you, JD.
Thank you. Hey, thanks, guys. What's next?
In 2022, by the way, the Yankees had an average age of 30, which was second highest in the MLB.
Yeah.
Only behind the Mets, ironically, other New York team. So this one coming from GQ, Paul George said winning a ring with the Clippers was going to be bigger than winning one with the Lakers. He said, and I quote, a championship with the Clippers 100% will outweigh a championship being with the Lakers. He said, bringing a first chip to this part of LA would be legacy defining. I know what he meant, but I don't know. Do you think he's out of pocket?
Joe,
I knew you wanted me to say it.
Joe, one thing here is I do like that you said, like you set up the thing. Like, Paul George says winning a ring with the Lakers would be bigger than winning one with the Lakers. And you're like, quote, he said a championship with the Lakers will be bigger than it.
I realized as I was halfway through, I was like, oh, I already spoiled it. I ruined it.
It was good.
I fumbled.
No, it's good. Is he out of pocket is the question here.
I know you love that question.
Yeah, I do. He's not out of pocket. He's just just stupid. He's trying too hard. The idea that it would be bigger in any way, as though there are people that would change allegiances or no, there's nothing. You're the Clippers, man. You are the Clippers forever.
Yeah.
The amount of years the Clippers would need to be good to change the complexion of the fan base. Like, it's the LA Lakers, for God's sakes. Yeah. It's like, look at the Brooklyn Nets. They got Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. And the Knicks,
and they had James Harden.
Stunk. And Knicks fans were still losing their minds, being like, we've bing all seen bing bong and outside hating on the Nets. It's great.
Yeah.
There's some markets you just can't change. What is weird, I didn't expect to go here with this, but I actually believe that when the Leafs, when there was almost that other second GTA team, that it would actually cause a divide, because the Leafs have been losers for so long and there's such a big pent-up frustration against them that
people would go there out of spite.
I think people would go to that team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, the Sens forever never took off because there were so many Leaf fans in Ontario that you would go to games in Ottawa, and there's more Leaf fans there than Senators fans. It's still pretty much like that, even despite all of the Sens success. I just think that people who are actually here, who are in the market, who have been frustrated with the ticket prices and the, like, the lack of success, the culture on the team, everything, whatever you want to say, that you would actually see some defectors. Mm. I think you really would see legitimate defectors. I don't think the Clippers or the Knicks are, they're two markets where there's too much history, there's too much success, people aren't changing. I shouldn't say too much success with the Knicks. It's been a minute, but
it has been a minute. How many years do you think it would take for the Clippers to get anywhere close to the Lakers in terms of
they'd have
popularity?
To have multiple championships.
Yeah.
Like multiple decades.
Yeah,
exactly.
At least.
With more championships than the Lakers.
And the Lakers would have to stink for like a while.
Yeah, no, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, it's never going to happen.
Anyway, Paul George, sad. Because he could have been a Laker, you know, and he's good. It would mean a lot. You go, playoff Oh, Muffet. No, it's not happening, dog. What are you talking about? Anyways, what's next?
JD, I was on Reddit last night. There's a post in r/Toronto about a sinkhole that is formed at Bay and Girard.
Okay.
Due to the sheer amount of rats burrowing underground.
Okay. This is disgusting. Terrifying.
Yeah. Have you ever had...
Thoughts and prayers with those at Bay and Girard. Like, if you're in that area right now, like...
Get out.
The photo attached to the post is just multiple holes from rats, and then just like multiple of those black traps, like beside all the different holes. And it's like, I don't think that's working.
So, it's nice to say.
I don't think that's working.
No, it's like really hard to kill rats. They're really smart.
Yeah.
Like, really, really smart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I used to have a big mice infestation at my old apartment.
Save that.
Save
your disgusting hovel story for a second. But that is relevant here, because I've seen a lot of mice in Toronto. I used to live in an apartment where there were mice here, like a bunch. And it's so unsettling when you sleep somewhere where there's rodents, mice, like bugs, whatever. Not great. No one wants roaches, obviously. But there's something about, like, you're in bed, you're about to fall asleep, and you hear like little mouse, like squeak, squeak, and it's just you're up. Damn it, get out of here. And I lived in a high rise, and that's even the thing where you're most annoyed, because you're like, I'm all the way up here, man. I'm minding my own business, 32 floors up in the sky, and you little mice came in here like, I'm sorry I left some crumbs on the floor. Was that an invitation for you? I've seen a lot of mice in Toronto. I know a lot of people who have had mice. I have lived here now for 20 years. Well, that was way too long. I've lived here for 13 years.
My whole life.
Yeah.
I almost died.
And actually, your whole life, because I'll kill you.
It'll be true.
You remind me of that again. I've seen a lot of mice. Yeah. I can count on one hand the amount of rats I've seen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that I can think of a rat in Liberty Village, a rat near my apartment, which freaked me out. I was pissed off about it. I was not pleased.
It ruined your weekend.
Yeah, because it was also like a disheveled rat. And it was like struggling around. And I was like, oh, that's the plague. It's in my area. I was so mad at that rat. Like, I'd rather see a young, big, fat, healthy rat than a limping around, sickly rat, you know? I'm like, where are you going to go die? Where are you going? Go die somewhere where somebody scoops you. Yes, exactly. Die in a very public, invisible place where someone in a hazmat suit scoops you up 5 seconds from now. And then I saw one downtown. That's the amount of rats I've seen.
Oh, We've got a lot more of rats.
I know we have
Hamilton.
A lot, but I've heard this forever. This is not news to me where Toronto is one of the big rat infested cities in North America. New York, we don't have their problem, but apparently we're close. But if in New York, guess what? I've been in New York twice. I've seen almost as many rats in New York. Oh,
big issue there.
As I have in all. So these suckers are making sinkholes and they're hiding underneath Bain Gerard. And that's it. And what I suggest is bomb them.
bomb Bain Gerard.
You got to evacuate all the people.
Last of Us.
Let all the rats think that they've got that. It's like, we gave it up. We said, you win, rats. Bomb. It's the only way. I hate rats. I would say in my power rankings of things I hate, rats, number one.
Really?
Have you ever met anybody with a pet rat?
I see them on TikTok,
I'm not close with anyone with a pet
rat. That's a sickness.
But it is weird.
I'll get in trouble for this, probably. But it is. You got pet rats, you're sick. Something's wrong. Something's broken in you. I think even ferrets is too far. Like any type of rodent.
Ferrets too far.
No,
snakes, ferrets are pet cool. Snake or pet rat?
Oh, snake.
Snake, easily.
Snake,
snakes are cool.
Yeah, a snake is, it's kind of a drug dealer move, but
But a snake is a better look than having a rat, on your nightstand.
No, of course.
A snake would kill you, and they wouldn't think twice about it.
A snake would kill you.
Well, if you're getting, an anaconda.
Would eat you?
That's rats would eat you.
Yeah, rats looking at you every day being like, just wait.
Well, rats also carry, the plague with them.
Yeah, no, dude, what are you talking about? No, snake, and not every snake is trying to eat you.
Yeah, it's not like you're getting, a boa constrictor or
something. You're right. I don't want to have a cobra in my apartment.
An anaconda.
Bitey?
That was what Dwight Howard used to do, though. He would have anacondas.
Sure, okay. All right.
Do you hear those stories of people who have a
Austin
pet snake
stat,
and they lose it?
That's an Austin stat right there where I'm like, what? All right. He's like, and Dwight Howard had anacondas. I'm like, okay. If you say so. I've never heard that before, but all right. Let's believe Austin on that one. Yeah. Rat has got to be the bottom tier of a pet.
Is there
their
anything
tails
worse?
Disgust
can you think
me.
Of? Anything worse than a rat?
No, I don't think so. Because you have a dirty, you've welcomed the enemy into your home.
That's true. You might as well just betray yourself.
No, it's disgusting.
You're just
so
betraying
wrong.
Your own family.
So wrong. Anyways, what's next? Before I get all the rat people on Twitter that are after me now for this.
New emojis are dropping, JD, in March or April. Part of iOS 16.4.
You're not an emoji guy.
Interesting.
Not really. Do I text emojis to you guys often? No.
All the time.
What? What emojis do I use?
Using the silly face.
Thumbs up.
No, I use thumbs up because I hate you guys, and that's my
please
way of being like,
me.
Yeah, that's enough.
Yeah. It's 9 p.m. Stop texting me, please.
Well, the new emojis are a lot of random ones. There's a moose, a jellyfish, a set of maracas.
I like the maracas.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually do see myself as when someone's like, hey, let's meet up or see you soon.
Yeah.
Maracas.
Mm. Maracas, yeah. Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
You know?
I like that idea.
Hey, see you in 10. Maracas. Cue the maracas. I'll be a maracas guy. Anyway, I'm going to be in on that. I don't really care. I'm pretty set in the emojis that I use. Mm. I'm set in my ways.
Yeah.
I like the cringe one, the teeth.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That seems like one that you would like.
Yeah, I do like that one. I actually hate when people thumbs up me. I think it's extremely rude when they hit me. I you know what I really don't like? I really don't like the features that the little reactions to text.
Oh, you don't like those? I love
those. No, it drives me nuts.
I use them all the time.
I know you do.
No, I know, but that was a death stare. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, anyway, I am not a fan of those. That's just annoying me.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. When people do, exclamation point on your text, I'm like,
okay, I can understand that.
It's all right, cool. What does that mean? Anyway, I don't know. I think that if you're a guy, you should have a daily limit of emojis you can use. Two.
No.
I said 10.
Two to 10. All right. We got to go. Subscribe to the podcast, leave 5 stars, and rat people stay out of my mentions.